I'm Sue Holderness, and welcome to All Stations, the new podcast from the Royal Air Force Benevolent Fund. This series is about overcoming adversity. In today's episode, we meet RAF veteran and Bomber Command pilot George Dunn, who flew Halifax bombers and Mosquitoes in World War II. George survived 44 missions during the war and has raised tens of thousands of pounds for the fund at air shows. Here is George's story in his own words.
My name is George Dunn and I'm 97 years of age. During the war, I was a pilot and on operational aircraft, I flew Halifaxes and Mosquitoes. During the course of the war, I flew 44 trips, 30 on Halifaxes and 14 on Mosquitoes. I was born at Whitstable on the North Kent coast, facing the Thames estuary. And when war broke out, I was just coming up to 17 years of age. When I got to 18, I decided that I wouldn't wait to be called up, because in those days, if you waited to be called up, you could be placed into the Army, Navy or the Air Force. Well, I had visions of the First World War, all the trench warfare and so on. So the Army was out, and Navy, well, I wasn't keen on the Navy, the fear of getting torpedoed and drowning. But of course, in 1940, being on the in Kent, I saw a lot of the Battle of Britain, the dogfights that went up over Sussex and, of course, Kent. And I thought, well, I think I'll probably have some of that. So I decided that I'd volunteer for aircrew. Because if you volunteered for aircrew, they couldn't touch you for anything else at all. Your national identity card was marked, mine in my case, under training pilot. So I was protected from being put in any other service. Well, the training was very good. I started off at what they called an initial training wing, which was a six-week course, and it was at Newquay in Cornwall. They were called ITWs, and this one I went to was number 8. For that 6 weeks, it was all really basic stuff. A little bit of Morse code, a little bit of meteorology, navigation, Air Force law, that sort of thing. And at the end of 6 weeks, I was posted up to a transit camp at West Kirby in the Wirral. I did my elementary flying training in Canada at a place called Caron, which was comprised 60 hours, and then moved on to a twin-engined station at Weyburn, which was about 18 miles southeast of Moose Jaw. And that was 120 hours on twin-engine Ansons. When I came back from Canada, we were sent to what was called an advanced flying unit on Oxfords to get ourselves acquainted with the flying conditions in this country, because Canada, of course, was all lit up, where this country was under blackout. So I did 45 hours on twin-engine Oxfords. From then on, I went up to OTU at Lossiemouth onto Wellingtons, where we formed our crew of 5. And then when we completed that, we went down to a place called Rufforth at just outside of York for conversion onto 4-engine Halifax. I'd only been there about 2 days, and I was sent to number 10 squadron at Melbourne in Yorkshire, because in those days, every pilot had to do 2 what we called second dicky trips, which was to go with an experienced crew as a second pilot to get used to the what was then the raids. First trip, of course, was to Essen, which was a good baptism because, of course, Essen was considered to be the most heavily defended target in the Ruhr. And the following night, I went back to Kiel. That was on, I think, the 2nd and 3rd of April, 1942. When I did those two second dickie trips, I hadn't even set foot in a Halifax. The normal procedure when you got to a heavy conversion unit was sometime during that time you would go to a squadron, but at least you would have been in a Halifax. You might even have done a few hours flying. But in my case, I hadn't set. So when I got into the 10 Squadron Halifax at Melbourne, I was really quite at sea. I didn't have the opportunity of getting to know the aircraft. I didn't have an opportunity to find out where the escape hatches were or what happened. So, and the flight engineer of that crew said to me, "That second pilot seat is mine for takeoff and landing. You can have it in between." So, of course, it was a strange business because I had no idea what the procedures were or anything. It was just a question of when we using my eyes as an extra pair of eyes to see what was going on outside. And of course, Essen, it really was heavily defended. And to see all this flak coming up when we got to the target, I thought to myself, by gum, if we're ever going to survive this, we're going to be lucky. I was only 19 at the time, so it was quite an experience to see all this flak bursting around us. You could hear it, but the thing, of course, you could smell the cordite, even in the cockpit. So if you've got flak bursting quite near you, the actual smell of it was quite prominent. When I got back from my two trips with the 10 Squadron, my crew naturally were very keen on knowing what it was like. So quite jokingly, I said to them, "Well, when you pack your gear to go on board, make sure you've got a clean pair of underpants." The first raid I did with my crew was to Dortmund, which was again in the Ruhr. Most of our trips at that time was in the Ruhr, which was commonly known as Happy Valley. The Ruhr was being targeted. That was called the Battle of the Ruhr, was starting around about March. So I was, our tour was right in the thick of the Battle of the Ruhr. And I was lucky. I had a very good crew. Everybody did their job as they should do. And we didn't have any problems. I insisted on a certain amount of discipline on the board. No indiscriminate talking. Only say something if you've got something important to say. We were fairly lucky. We had I wouldn't say we had an easy tour, because no raid is easy, but we were never attacked by a night fighter. My gunners never had to fire a shot in anger. So in that respect, one could say, well, we had a very lucky tour. The worst experience I had wasn't anything to do with the enemy. It was the weather. Hamburg, which was Operation Gomorrah, Hamburg was attacked very heavily in three raids. On the third raid, the weather was atrocious. We shouldn't really have ever gone. And about halfway across, we ran into cloud almost straight away after takeoff. Halfway there, or about halfway there, my airspeed indicator, I stopped. The airspeed indicator is worked by air pressure. And there's a what they call the pitot head, which is underneath the stubber wing. And it's heated. And you always made sure that the pitot head was switched on, the heater was switched on at the time of doing your cockpit drill. But the icing was so bad that the pitot head iced up and my airspeed indicator just dropped away to zero. So I had to make a decision. Do we carry on or do we turn back? Now, I was always reluctant to turn back because I felt that once you were up there, you really wanted to get the job done. So I decided I'd carry on. Okay, the navigator wouldn't have an airspeed to work on. So it was a question of making the best of it. I used what was called my altimeter, a rate of climb indicator. So I deliberately kept my rate of climb down a bit lower so that I knew I was flying at a safe speed. About 15 minutes before we got to the target, we ran into the most severe electrical storm. The lightning was hitting the aircraft. The electricity was running from the framework around the windows of the cockpit. And ice was coming off the prop braids and hitting the aircraft. And it was really a most frightening experience. I was more scared of the outcome of that than ever I was against flak or night fighters. It got to the stage where it was so turbulent, we were getting the ice was mounting up on the main planes, and very reluctantly I decided that we would have to jettison and turn around, which we did. We were only 15 minutes from the target, which was pretty much a shame. But I got the safety of the crew to think about. So we turned around and jettisoned the bombs. And about halfway back, suddenly the airspeed indicator came back on as the ice was decreasing. But that was the most frightening experience I had during the whole tour. On August the 17th, 1943, I took part in one of the most important raids of the war. When we got to the briefing room that afternoon, I noticed that there were extra RAF police on the door, which was most unusual. Usually there were just a couple checking your identity and that. But this time there were about four. When we got in, of course, the curtains were drawn across the briefing board. And when they pulled the curtains back, we couldn't quite believe what we were seeing. The route was right up the North Sea, across Denmark, to avoid the heavy flak on Hamburg and Rostock and Bremen. And then as we approached, we were actually heading towards Berlin. Now, in the main force, they included a small force of 8 Mosquitoes, which went on to Berlin as a spoof raid to make them think that the main target was Berlin, because in those days, Berlin was getting bombed quite frequently. And we turned off left to Peenemünde. Now, going back to the briefing, we were given the usual thing by the armaments officer, the meteorological officer, and so on. At the end of the briefing, there's a punchline, the squadron commander said, "Oh, by the way, if you don't do the job tonight, you'll go back tomorrow night and the night after." Because it had been explained to us nothing at all about it being a rocket research station, anything like that. No mention of rockets. The only thing we were told was it was a secret research station connected with radar, which was very important to the well-being of this country. And that was the reason why they were telling us that we had got to do the job, whether we did it that night or the following night. Well, of course, as you can imagine, if we'd had to go back the following night, what the reception committee would have been. Now, up to that point, Peenemunde had never been raided, and the reconnaissance aircraft that had been over there several times were never fired upon because the Germans didn't want to indicate that there was anything going on there. Now, the raid was in three waves, two bomber groups to each wave. Now, originally, our group, which was four group, was going in the third wave, but it was changed. We were moved to the first wave because they were frightened that our aiming point, there were three aiming points, the housing establishment, the experimental works, and the production works, two bomber groups to each wave. So we were then moved to the first wave because they thought the smoke detonators were going to obscure our target. So actually, we went straight through. We ran in from the north, straight through. It was a glorious night, absolutely no cloud, moonlight. And we went in at 7,000 feet, which was about 11 or 12,000 feet below what we normally bombed. But of course, as it was such a precision target, they wanted us to be sure that it was going to get hit. So we went through our two groups, went through on our raid, a little bit of light flak, and we were gone. Meanwhile, over Berlin, the German ground staff couldn't make out why there was no activity above, apart from the eight mosquitoes, and they didn't know that. And eventually, it was only when one of the German night fighter pilots spotted the flames from Peenemunde that they realised that that was where the main raid was. And of course, it was still 20 minutes flying time for the night fighters to get to Peenemunde. So it was about halfway through the raid before the night fighters got there. And then, of course, they had a field day. I mean, it was, as I said before, it was a brilliant moonlight night. Aircraft could be seen, and we lost 40 in those last two waves. We found out from the newspapers, it must have been the following day or the day after, that it was for the production of V1s and V2s. The thing was, we were a little bit at tenterhooks the following day until we realised that we weren't going to go back, because I think it was 3 days after the raid that Hitler and Goebbels and Speer, the armaments minister, actually visited the site and decided that they would have to move the whole production mostly to the Harz Mountains in Austria. So we heaved a very big sigh of relief, because as you can imagine, it would have been an absolute massacre if we'd had to go back the second night. The country were spared a lot of the rockets that might have dropped had the raid not taken place at that time. In fact, General Eisenhower, in his book Crusade to Europe, said that the Second Front would have been seriously compromised had it not been for Peenemünde. Made us feel quite happy to think we'd done a good job. As a squadron, we didn't lose an awful lot of aircraft in my time. The worst loss was actually on my final trip to Kassel, when we lost four aircraft, which was quite unusual for one squadron. These aircraft were just lost. No explanation as to why. Just unlucky, I suppose. When you land back at base after a raid, you get debriefed. And there will be, if there were aircraft missing from the squadron, first of all, you wouldn't know whether they'd been shot down. You wouldn't know whether the crew had bailed out. You wouldn't know whether they'd got back to this country and landed at another airfield as an emergency. So it would probably be, you would go to bed and you would wake up and there'd be empty beds beside you. So you were hoping that they got back somewhere. But as time went on during the following day, it would become obvious that they had actually been lost. And that's when but you couldn't afford to let it prey on your mind, because you might be on the following night. So you just say, well, just too bad. I hope it won't be my turn tonight. Over the course of the war, I think we, as a crew, we had a very lucky experience, because we didn't get attacked by night fighters at all. We did get hit by flak, but not seriously. And I did a full 30 trips because I had my two in the bag, but the crew didn't have to do those extra trips. They were excused. I like to think that myself and my crew, both crews, the Halifax crew and the chap I had as a navigator on Mosquitoes, that we did, we made a good contribution to what was eventually a satisfactory result, and that I was feeling quite proud that I was able to make a contribution to that. And it gives me a lot of pleasure to know that I can continue contributing in some way for the benefit of those who were not quite so fortunate as I was and came out unscathed. And I get a lot of pleasure out of it. Well, I'm 97 now, and the hardest bit is not having something to do. So by using my efforts to assist the Benevolent Fund, makes it all the more easier to go on living. And I'm hoping that I can carry on doing this for a few more years.
Well, George, it's lovely to meet you at last. You must have so many memories of World War II. Do you think of those times often?
Oh, quite often. I go to bed and sometimes think back to when I was on the squadron and when I was in Canada and all the other things we used to get up to. Memories are still there.
How old were you when you went into the RAF?
18 years.
You were a baby.
Yeah.
Now, and what do you think the impact of your service in the RAF has had on your life now?
Well, I think one of the main things was discipline. You get discipline in the service, which a lot of the young people don't get today. And I think that stays with you throughout your life. Discipline and respect for other people.
And of course, when you were in the RAF, the bomber command you were with, weren't you? And you suffered very heavy losses in World War II. I mean, I can never really understand how you very young men coped with that.
Well, I think we felt that it was a job that we had to do. And if you dwelt too much on the loss of your comrades, then it didn't do you any good for yourself. I mean, we used to wake up in the morning, and if a crew had gone missing that was bunking in your billet, you'd wonder at that stage whether they came back or whether they might have landed at some other airfield in an emergency. But as it got later in the day and they didn't appear, you realised then that that they were gone. But you just had to put those things behind you. Otherwise, you couldn't do your job.
Of course, because life expectancy for the bomber pilot was not good, was it?
No, it was about 6 weeks, I think.
Gosh. I mean, the operation I'm fascinated by is that amazing time when you were in charge of trying to get rid of that whole setup that was creating the V2 bomb, weren't you? That brilliant German rocket scientist, Walter Thiel, that's who you wanted to get rid of. And that mission must have been very scary, wasn't it?
You're talking about the Peenemünde raid.
I am.
Yes. There were three aiming points. There was the housing complex, where all the scientists and the technicians were. And then there was the experimental works and the production works. Three aiming points, two bomber groups to each aiming point. Our two groups were in and out. No trouble at all.
But the third wave.
So it was the second and third waves that really copped it.
It suffered.
Mm.
And I read somewhere that you were bombing from only 8,000...
We went in at 7,000.
And it was usually, what, 18, 19?
We were 18, usually 18, 19. But because it was such a precision target, I mean, Peenemünde itself, the establishment, probably wasn't much bigger than about two football pitches.
Gosh.
So it had to be quite precise. And, of course, we relied on the Pathfinder force to mark the target accurately.
Must have been quite scary from that height.
Well, no, you see, it was a glorious night. There was no cloud. It was a brilliant moonlight night. You could see the streets at 7,000 feet.
Gosh.
You could see the target aiming points.
Can you remember what your thoughts and your feelings were during that time? Fear, or do you just get on with it?
Well, we just got on with it. I mean, we realised that going through on the first wave, we were lucky. We had a bit of light flak, but nothing to be worried about. But of course, the later waves really copped it. See, we weren't told that it was a V1 and a V2 rocket.
Oh, you didn't know that?
No. We were only told that it was a secret research station, which, if it was allowed to continue, would have quite serious effects on the country.
Mm.
And therefore, if we didn't do it that night, you'll go back the following night and the following night until you do it. So you can imagine what the reception committee would have been on the second night if we'd had to go in again.
Oh, gosh, yes. But in fact, it was successful and damaged the smooth development of the V2 guided ballistic missile and really made a huge difference to the war, didn't it?
It did, yeah. Although, you see, this was in August 43, but the first V2 rocket didn't fall on English soil until September the 8th, 1944.
So you delayed it by that long?
That was at Chiswick, and that was the first V2 to fall. That had been fired from 200 miles away in Holland.
Absolutely terrifying.
Yeah,
I bet.
So that was
In fact, you went back to Peenemünde recently, didn't you?
I went back in 2018.
How was that?
It was great because one of the things that surprised me was I got such a lovely reception from the German people. A gentleman from the Midlands kindly laid on his private jet, and I went out. I was the only veteran, but there were other people, two or three people on board, and I laid a wreath on the memorial there. And the thing was, when we were up on the power station, which is now the museum, a young couple with two small children came up to me and said, do you mind if we have a photograph taken of you? Which I thought was great.
Lovely. That's really lovely. Must have been very very emotional for you.
Well, it was really. There is actually quite a lot of the Peenemünde, which is still closed off, which rather surprised me.
As a sort of museum?
I don't know. Even the curator of the museum couldn't lay any thoughts about it.
Interesting.
So why, after all these years, it's still closed off, I don't know.
So when the war came to an end, you didn't stay with the RAF, did you?
No, I came out in June 47.
And you went to Pickford's?
I went to my old firm, yes. In those days, the government criteria was that companies had to give you your job back.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yes.
And you had worked for Pickford's for what, about 4 years?
When I was 14, yeah.
Left school at 14?
Yeah. God. Junior clerk at 14, flying a bomber at 18.
It's incredible. I know when my son got to that age, I couldn't help, because my father and his two brothers flew in the war, I just couldn't imagine what he and his chums would have done. But I suppose they too would have leapt to the cause if it was what was expected.
Yeah.
Seems hard to believe they could do it, but it's a remarkable achievement that you all, and that you're still here to tell us about it is what really wonderful.
Yeah, I wouldn't have given myself that chance all those years ago.
And so now you are a ripe old age. How are you coping with that, George?
Very well.
Still driving, I hear.
Still driving, and I like to do my bit for the Benevolent Fund.
Yes, we must talk about that. Yeah, we're sitting here in the lovely Princess Marina house. Have you spent much time here?
Here?
Yes.
Oh, yes, I've been coming here on and off for about 10 years.
Oh, have you? Now, tell me a bit about the house. What do you do here?
Oh, it's beautiful. I mean, everything is on tap. The rooms are great, the bathrooms, the food is excellent, and the staff. Well, I can't say enough about the staff. They're so kind.
Well, we've got a member of the staff here. We could ask...
I'd still say that she wasn't here.
Well, we've got Tammy Fleming here. So, Tammy, perhaps you can tell us a bit more about the house.
Princess Marina House has been going now for 50 years. We just celebrated our 50th year anniversary.
50? Gosh.
50. The Benevolent Fund has been going for 100 years this year, so we've had a double celebration. I've been here for 14 years looking after the activities and the entertainment. Yeah, so when George and people like George come and stay, I organise the activities and the entertainment to keep them busy or relaxed while they're here.
And it's not just World War II veterans who come here, is it?
No, it's any RAF serving, past serving people. And we actually do now take other forces with us. So it's not just the RAF.
And reservists too?
Yes.
Anyone who's had any connection with the RAF and is in some sort of trouble can come here?
It used to be just RAF. Now it's National Service and Army and Navy as kindred.
And you really want to spread the word that this facility is available?
Absolutely. It's just such a fantastic place to come and recoup.
Don't get too many here, otherwise it won't remove for me.
Well, yeah, this is the problem. It's like you say, but people that come back time and time again because it is really, it's like a 5-star hotel that gives care.
So people don't actually live here. They'll come here for a sort of respite.
We stopped residents staying here in 2004-5, the year I started here. And the last resident passed away this year. So we're now just a respite care home.
Tammy, what do you think? What do you get out of working here?
I just love working here. It's a very magical place. The staff are just so friendly that the minute anybody walks through the door, I believe that they feel that they're part of our family. Everybody just enjoys working here. To me, it's seeing characters like George and listening to their stories, being able to help. Sometimes they come in the door very jaded and sort of down and isolated, and within sometimes hours, sometimes maybe a day, you start seeing the change in people. They're sort of getting themselves back. They get their independence. They get to mix and have social lives. We take them out on the trips, take them to places that they've never been. We took one lady out to the Brighton Wind Farm before. We take them on day trips on their boats and things like that. We have a lot of not forgotten things. George went up to the New Forest last time he was with us. I had an old lady. Yes, I'm sorry, George. I had a lady who was 104 when she passed, but when she was here for 100, we did a cheese tasting, and she'd never ever tasted goat's cheese in her life, and she absolutely loved it.
So she loved it. Oh, good.
And every time she came back, she was telling me, "I keep having goat's cheese. I keep having goat's cheese." So just allowing them to do things that they haven't done before, even at a grand old age. So it's just a five-star hotel with care. Like I say, it's an amazing place. The people we meet and the stories they tell us.
You've found the perfect job, haven't you?
I have. I actually wasn't intending to stay here. I came here as a sort of a helping hand. And if somebody turned around and told me I was going to be in a care home, I would have laughed at them. And 14 years later, I'm still here and I have no intentions of leaving.
I don't think George wants you to leave. No. Hang on in here.
Yes, absolutely. It's a pleasure working here. George usually comes for Easter, don't you, George? And yeah, again, this sort of time of year as well.
So. Lovely. The other thing is extraordinary to me that you did an awful lot of raids, didn't you? You had 30 sorties in Halifaxes and 14 in Mosquitoes. Which plane did you like best?
Without doubt, the Mozzie.
Yeah, my dad said that too. Everybody seems to love the Mozzie. That was the one.
Well, when you think about it, flying time in a Halifax to Berlin was just over 8 hours. My first trip in a Mozzie to Berlin, there and back, was 4.25.
Incredible change, wasn't it? How did you refuel? I never understand about all that.
Refuel?
Yeah.
Didn't need to.
You could get all the way there and back. Amazing plane. There aren't very many of them left, are there? You've had a flight in a plane recently, haven't you?
A Spitfire. At Biggin Hill, yeah.
How old were you then?
This was a few months ago.
And you're still driving.
This was just before D-Day. When I first heard about it, that I was going to go up in the Spitfire, I mean, it was 73 years since I flew the last one. And it was a great feeling because I knew that I'd be able to, up to a point, fly it. You're not allowed to do the takeoff or the gardening. That's part of the rules of the game.
So you weren't completely in control, but you were allowed to take the controls once you got up.
Yeah, when you got up there, he says, "Okay, it's yours." And from then on, it all came back quite easily. It's a little bit like riding a bike. You don't actually forget.
I'm sure.
It was great. It was only. It went too quickly. That was the trouble.
Did you fight very gently, or were you allowed to
You did a couple of rolls.
You good rolls.
Yeah. So all in all, it was a great experience, and one that I thought I'd never have.
How exciting! You got to do it again.
Yeah. You see, but another thing about going over there on that day was they've got a Spitfire that came over from the museum at Athens. It came over in crates completely, nothing of it.
So they had to reassemble the whole thing?
He's doing the whole thing. And when I checked my logbook, I found that in January 46, I did the final test on that one before it went over to Greece.
George, how extraordinary. That's terribly romantic, isn't
so,
it?
I'm
glad they put it back together again.
Well, it's well underway. It's got the wings back on. They're just waiting now to put the engine in and other bits and pieces.
I think you've got to have another flight in that, haven't
well,
you?
Well, hopefully it's going to be airworthy by May, and then it's going to be flown back to Athens in stages by one of their pilots. Unfortunately, it's only a single-engine aircraft, so
perhaps miss that one.
I can't participate in that.
No,
it was a lovely experience, and certainly one that I shall never forget.
So, George, you look tip-top and fit as a flea. How about your friends? Have you got very many left?
There's only two of us now out of originally 14. When we started coming down here in 2009, we formed a little group from the Aircrew Association, and we started off with signing books and prints at garden centres. And then we got in with a publisher, Steve Darlow, who you know. It was then we started to get funds for the memorial. And when that was finished, we diverted our efforts to the Benevolent Fund. And we started doing air shows, quite a few during the course of a year. And we used to come down here. There were 14 of us, and we used to congregate in the pavilion there with rather a large number of bottles on the table.
I'm glad to hear it.
and when we turned up, they used to say, "Oh, not you lot again." Because we were credited with livening the place up.
I bet you did. Earlier, I think you said that your great, wonderful health is due to wine, women and song. I hope there weren't too many women around.
Well, there were some wives and partners about to keep us in order.
Well, that's good. That sounds as though you needed them there to keep you under control. Well, you all obviously all had a lot of fun together. It must be very sad when you lose them.
Yeah. Well, yes, we've lost three in the last 4 or 5 months. One chap was 100, a chap called Joe Lancaster, very appropriate name. He was a great man. You don't dwell on it, you know. We must carry on down to the last one.
You were an amazing generation. Well, it looks as though we're going to have you for a long time, please God. I want to know what you're on.
Red wine.
Gin.
Red wine and gin. That's a pretty good recipe. Let's all try that. George, thank you so much for talking to us. It's a great joy to meet you.
My pleasure.
For the past 100 years, the Fund has always been there to support RAF veterans, serving RAF personnel and their families when they've needed us. But now, as we mark our centenary, we're asking for your help to find thousands more RAF veterans who are eligible for our support. Some may not know that they can get help. Others may be too proud to ask. They're under the radar. But we are determined to find them before it's too late. Join the search. Change a life. Next time on All Stations.
Loneliness is a peculiar thing to define. You can be lonely in a crowd, can't you? You've got to make yourself meet people halfway. If Brian was here today, he'd be extremely pleased to see me still coming here and enjoying it and enjoying the companionship of Maureen.